The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back to our reading from the October 2023 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is Annual Mountain Issue, Autumn in the Smokies. And let's get headed out there with an article entitled The Legendary Lodge. In the early 1900s, a self-made businessman fell in love with Graham County and spared no expense in building an extravagant hunting preserve there. A century later, his granddaughter visits to find all that's left of his Hooper Ball dream is local lore and wild boar. Written by Mickey Rathbun. In April 1912, a train stopped in the quiet Smoky Mountain town of Murphy to deliver a most unusual cargo, 14 wild boar from Russia and 4 bison from the western United States. The beasts, some shaggy, others bristly, were visible through the slats in their wooden crates. It's easy to imagine that their grunts, rumbles, and squeals were deafening, their stench eye-watering. A crew of men assembled to wrangle the animals onto ox-drawn wagons for the arduous trip to their final destination, Hooper Bald, at 5,429 feet, one of the tallest peaks in Graham County. According to Joy Stewart of Robbinsville, who has researched their operation, word got out ahead of time about the arrival of the animals, and people lined the roads to watch. It was like a zoo coming to town, she says. Although the distance was only 25 miles, the journey over a rough dirt track across Hanging Dog Mountain took 3 days. Hooper Bald was the site of the most unusual installation that Western North Carolina had ever seen, a 1,600-acre private hunting reserve stocked with exotic game animals. The creator of this folly was my grandfather, a freewheeling business tycoon named George Gordon Moore. The ultimate self-made man, he was the youngest of 10 children in a family that had fled the Irish potato famine in the 1840s and settled in southern Ontario. Moore was extremely intelligent. He was said to have had a photographic memory, and at age 21 was a partner in a Michigan law firm. With a keen nose for business, he made his first fortune in the early 1900s developing electric rail systems in burgeoning Midwestern cities. He multiplied his bankroll by buying and consolidating electric power and railroad companies in Georgia and elsewhere. He moved his business operations to London so that he could obtain capital from wealthy British investors eager to put their money into the abundant natural resources of the New World. The advent of railroads and steam-powered machines, coupled with a huge demand for lumber on the East Coast and in Europe, triggered a boom in the North Carolina timber industry at the turn of the 20th century. In 1908, Moore arranged the sale of 100,000 acres of prime timberland near Robbinsville to a syndicate of British investors. As his broker's fee, what he calls his perquisite, he claimed a long-term lease on 1,600 acres atop Hooper Bald. Nowhere have I ever seen anything so beautiful as this wild section of the Great Smokies, he wrote to a friend years later. Rhododendrons 40 feet high, the widest variety of foliage imaginable, and views of three states from Hooper Bald Mountain, the highest peak in the center of it. Moore had hunted boar on a private estate in Belgium and wanted to replicate the experience in the Smokies. His aim was to create his own hunting preserve in the tradition of Gilded Age getaways, places where America's elite, the Roosevelts, Whitneys, and Vanderbilts, went to hunt, fish, and rough it with friends and family. Given the remoteness of the site, it was a preposterous undertaking, but Moore had the passion and money to make it happen. In 1908, Hooper Bald was accessible only by foot and on horseback. To build his compound, Moore hired a group of locals, including a young man from Andrews named Garland McGuire, known as Cotton because of his nearly white hair. McGuire was smart and capable, and Moore soon appointed him as foreman. The first order of business was to build a 20-mile road from Andrews, the nearest railroad depot, to the Bald so that the wagons could bring in materials. As quickly as supplies could be delivered, construction of the hunting lodge and the caretaker's cabin for McGuire began. Like everything else he did, Moore conceived his lodge on a grand scale. It was 90 feet long and 45 feet wide, built of thick chestnut logs and topped with shingles of white oak, all milled on the property. It contained 10 bedrooms off of a central hallway, 2 full bathrooms, a kitchen, a dining room, and a large central gathering place called the lobby. When I visited Robbinsville several years ago, one of McGuire's children told me that the fireplace was so big that mule teams were needed to drag in the 5-foot logs that fueled it. Moore insisted on all the modern comforts of home. Water for indoor plumbing, unheard of then in Graham County, was piped in from a spring-fed concrete cistern. A wood-fired furnace off of the kitchen heated water supply to supply the 2 bathtubs where guests could soak after a day of sport. Moore also installed a telephone, another first for the county, a feat that required stringing telephone wires through the Snowbird Mountains from the town of Marble, more than 20 miles to the southeast. Not content with kerosene lanterns, he put in a Delco light plant, a small internal combustion generator that provided electricity for the lighting. His installation drew curiosity seekers from miles around. People came to Hooper Bald just to see the indoor bathrooms. While the lodge was under construction, Moore assembled a virtual Noah's Ark of big game animals. In addition to the bison and Russian boar, he purchased 34 bears from several zoos, 200 wild turkeys, and 4 more bison, as well as 6 Colorado mule deer and 14 elk. Throughout the summer of 1912, these animals arrived by train in Andrews and Murphy, where they were loaded onto wagons for the 3-day trek to Hooper Bald. To contain the boar, Moore directed McGuire and his crew to build a 600-acre pen surrounded by a 9-rail high fence constructed of solid chestnut timbers. For the buffalo and the other animals, a 1,000-acre lot was enclosed with a 10-foot barbed wire fence. Nearly a mile in circumference, it required 25 tons of double-stranded barbed wire. Once the preserve was complete, Moore began to entertain clients and friends there. McGuire would pick up visitors at the train station in Murphy and bring them to the lodge, a trip of 3 hours in a mule-drawn wagon. Even in the Smoky Mountains wilderness, Moore prided himself on his extravagant hospitality. He hired expert local guides to lead hunting excursions all over the property. The alien beasts were not always easy to manage. The bears had no difficulty climbing out of their wire enclosure. As former zoo animals, they were all too comfortable with humans and frequently appeared at the hunting lodge, demanding to be fed. One night, Moore arrived at Hooper Ball to find one of his guests, a young Englishman, with his arm and leg bandaged from wounds that he'd suffered while trying to oust a bear from his room. With his typical insouciance, Moore claimed to have found the bear's antics amusing. It soon became apparent that the local hounds were not up to the challenge of boar hunting. Moore crossed an Irish wolfhound, a breed described as fast enough to catch a wolf and strong enough to kill it, with a Great Dane, producing a hound that, as he put it, could credibly hold his own. Moore's prey did not disappoint. "Wild boar always have the initiative," he wrote. "You can never tell whether they'll run away from you or run at you. All the action any hunter wants." One fateful day, a guest took a shot at a boar, missed his target, and killed the favorite coonhound of Moore's chief hunter, Devereaux Birchfield. In those days, human life was a cheap commodity in the Great Mountains, Moore wrote. A good coonhound was slightly more valued than a child. Birchfield had already killed 3 men for less important causes than the death of his coonhound. I suddenly found that I had urgent business elsewhere, and early the next morning the entire party returned to New York. Over the next few years, Moore's visits to Hooper Ball became less frequent. His involvement in the war in Europe and his far-flung business interests left little time for hunting. In his absence, Cotton McGuire and the hunting guides kept Moore's guests entertained. But conditions at the lodge were difficult. The hot water system was finicky. Winters were bitterly cold, and the pipes would freeze and break, requiring McGuire's constant attention. By the early 1920s, Moore owed McGuire more than $1,000 in back pay. He had not been to Hooper Ball for more than a year. He summoned McGuire to New York, where he handed him $1,000 and the lease to Hooper Ball. "It's all yours," he told him. McGuire stayed on the Ball for several years, but he couldn't afford to maintain the property, and the lease eventually reverted to the property owners. When I stood on Hooper Ball, awestruck by the spectacular scenery, I imagined my grandfather admiring much the same view more than 100 years earlier. Although he left few traces there, he did leave a dubious legacy. Some of his boar escaped and bred with local wild hogs, their population quickly spreading throughout the South. And his sojourn on Hooper Ball remains a legend in Robbinsville and beyond. And now, trout. Anglers come from all around to fish the cold, clear waters of the Great Smoky Mountains, where the trout is the prize. And while some seek the thrill that comes with casting a line, others are content to enjoy the fish on their plate. The Fish Whisperer. A renowned fishing guide in Robbinsville knows just where to find the Smokies' favorite catch. Written by Graham Averill. There's a nice picture here of a river meandering through low hills. The caption says, Jared Schuster of Smoky Mountain Kayak Fishing, seen here on the picture on the right in a tiny little kayak, often guides angling expeditions on Lake Santalia, where trout lurk far below the surface. It's been said that trout are so smart, so perceptive, that they can hear not only when you're approaching, but also how much change you have in your pocket when you cast. They're so elusive that they've inspired songs and driven fisher folk mad. Although they thrive in the cold, crisp waters of our mountain rivers and lakes, their abundance does not guarantee success for the angler. That's why Jared Schuster, one of the most sought-after fishing guides in the region, dedicates a significant portion of his life to trying to catch them. It's the challenge, he says. Throughout the year, trout change locations, diet, and feeding habits. I enjoy trying to keep up with them. It's satisfying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and be rewarded with a good day of fishing. If you want to give yourself a decent shot at landing one of these majestic creatures, you'll best get on the water early when the fish are most active. You'd better pick that water wisely. Schuster and I meet at the edge of Lake Santitla, a serene reservoir tucked into a remote corner of the mountains. I've been casting for trout on my own for years, stalking the mountains of northern Georgia and North Carolina since I was a teenager. I've had some success over the years, but I've been skunked or gone home empty-handed more often than I'd like to admit. Today I'll find out if Schuster is the real deal. Although Schuster guides on a handful of lakes in Graham County, the 2,881-acre Santitla is his favorite because of its diversity of fish species. The dark waters hold loudmouth and smallmouth bass, crappie, walleye, and bream. But it's the large, wild rainbow and brown trout that Schuster is after. There's even a thriving population of steelheads, a migratory form of rainbow trout more common in the north and west that spend most of their lives in oceans or cold mountain lakes, swimming up tributary streams to spawn every fall. The mountains come down to the edge of Lake Santitla, the Smokies rising to the north, and the Chihuahuas dominating the eastern horizon. Roughly 75% of the shoreline is protected as Nantahala National Forest, so there are relatively few houses on the lake. There aren't even many trails or campgrounds on the shore. I'm on the water over 200 days each year, and I never get over the scenery. The sun rises and the sun sets, Schuster says as we set off. The beauty of the area may be irresistible to humans, but what draws trout to Santitla is its depth. The lake has channels up to 189 feet deep, which allow the trout to retreat to cold water even during the hottest days of summer. We're in kayaks that we propel by foot pedals, almost like riding a bike, and steer with a small handle on the left side of the boat. A computer screen, fed by a sonar system, shows us the topography of the bottom of the lake and the schools of fish that swim beneath us. We're trolling, which means that we drop a shiny artificial lure designed to look like a tasty fish deep into the water and then drag it behind us, maintaining a steady 1.7 mile per hour speed to keep the decoy fish moving at an attractive pace. I have three lines in the lake, each rod sandwiched into plastic holders. If there's tension on the line, I have to start reeling it in immediately. Schuster has his own boat with three or four rods outfitted in case I have an equipment issue. Of the roughly 600 trips he's led in western North Carolina, He's only been skunked twice. That's partly because trolling, Schuster explains, is the best way to catch lake trout in deep water. Trolling from kayaks adds to the experience. The kayaks allow you to cover a lot of water, but you're not removed from the action like you would be if you were standing on the deck of a large boat, he says. I like being on the water, not above it. I like being close to the action and the fish. I want to give my clients the best overall experience possible. And I think fishing from a kayak offers the whole package. Schuster grew up on a horse farm in Wisconsin, enjoying a childhood filled with bow hunting and pond fishing. Later he learned to fly fish and eventually started exploring the deeper waters of the Great Lakes. He was guiding fly fishing clients by the age of 23, but always as a side gig, something to do when he wasn't at his day job. Early on, he made a living as a chef, working mostly with wild game like elk and boar. Later, after getting married, he transitioned to an office job, managing sales for a major food distribution company. He worked 80-hour weeks and was successful but stressed. I was going in the wrong direction and was completely burned out, Schuster says. It got to the point where the ding of my iPhone would trigger heartburn. He and his wife discovered Graham County while on a motorcycle tour, riding the famously curvy Tail of the Dragon, southwest of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. He fell in love with the area instantly and orchestrated a move. Schuster started guiding fishing in kayaks on the local lakes as a way to take a breather and reorganize his life. But then the pandemic hit, and suddenly everybody wanted to be outside. I was just supposed to be a side hustle while I figured things out, but I got busy fast, Schuster says. The pandemic gave me a good jump start to the business. The lake is quiet as we fish, the only sounds coming from our boats and Schuster as he tells stories. Within a few minutes of launching off the bank, I get a bite and reel in a small white bass. Schuster scoops it up with a net and releases it back in the water unceremoniously. We're in the market for trout, after all. And I reset the rod so it's trolling 50 feet below. Schuster is a bit superstitious and has let me out exactly 111 feet of line. That's the magic number, he says. Not 110, not 112, 111. Fish love that number. We move across the lake, always keeping an eye on the Garmin screens attached to our kayaks to make sure we're hovering above the deepest channels in the lake. One of my rod tips jerks, and I move to start reeling in a fish. All of the action is behind me, but the fish feels heavy, like I'm tugging on a whale. As I get the beast closer to my boat, Schuster pulls out his net, ready to land it for me. It's a steelhead, bright and silver, probably 19 or 20 inches. But just as I pull it close enough to see, the fish spits out my hook and vanishes deep into the channel beneath our boat. It's frustrating to get so close to landing a fish like that, just to lose it at the last second. The same thing happens to me a little later in the day. I hook a steelhead and fight the feisty monster to the edge of my boat, only to lose it before we can get it in the net. I catch a small white bass that Schuster decides to keep, so we have something to eat, and we start making our way back to the shore. The trout are being stubborn today. They were probably up all night feeding on a hatch of bugs hitting the surface of the water, he explains, and now they're full and sleepy. But that's what makes trout so fun to catch, he says. Fishing for bass is easy. They're plentiful and typically feed in shallow water. But to keep fish, or rather but to fish deep water, targeting multiple species of trout, is very technical. You have to consider a lot of factors: depth of the water, temperature, time of the year, color of the bait, the wind. You never really know what's going on down there. I like the mystery of fishing over deep water for trout. Before we call it a day, I hook another fish. It doesn't put up much of a fight, so I think it's another bass. But as Schuster reaches out with his net, we see a colorful rainbow trout, maybe 13 inches long. It's not huge, but it's beautiful. I feel like I'm 12 years old again, full of pride as my dad helps me reel in my first catch. Back on the shore where we launched earlier in the morning, Schuster pulls out a charcoal grill, two-burner stove, and a white folding table from the back of his truck. He dices up my white bass for a gumbo with fresh vegetables, then fillets my fillet trout and grills it with a spicy remoulade and corn. Schuster seems comfortable here in his makeshift kitchen, just a few yards from the water, a sharp chef's knife in his hand, and fresh fish on the grill. When I ask him why he left a successful career to help other people catch trout, he doesn't hesitate. It's the juxtaposition of it all, he says. You're out in the middle of nowhere on the water, which is soothing. But then you get a trout to bite, and it's like this huge release of anticipation, a great burst of adrenaline. There's nothing else in the world like that combination of relaxation and excitement. It took him a long time to land in these mountains to find this accidental career. But now, settling in the role of fishing guide, he's in his element. Well, we just have 1 minute left, so I am going to take a look at some of the advertisements here in our state magazine. Del Webb Homes would like you to feel that you love where you live. 55 plus active adult living. They're sponsoring Carolina Gardens in Fuquay-Varina and Carolina Overland. And then there's an ad for Lake Santitla in North Carolina. It's located within a remote and rural area of western North Carolina mountains, bordering the Great Smoky Mountains, NP. Your gateway to natural wonders, and you can learn more at discoversantitla.com. And finally, Harry Kotler Jewelers was established in 1848. Made by hand, shaped by history, Schiffman's Jewelers, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, Schiffman's.com. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.